Welcome to History's Hotties, the podcast that discusses the sometimes forgotten but influential women in American history, and I am your host, Krista. Welcome back to any of you that have listened before, and welcome also to any of you that are first-time listeners. I know I disappeared for a long time. Our family spent the last couple of years at a very busy assignment, but we have moved again, and I am so excited to have some time to share my passion for history and the women who make it interesting. In this episode, we are going to talk a bit about a woman who made the gutsy move of writing a tell-all about her famous employer, a move that some have regretted and some have embraced. Ladies like Margaret Powell, who wrote Below Stairs, used by Julian Fellowes to help create the Downton Abbey series, Carrie White, who was the hairdresser to stars like Elizabeth Taylor and Goldie Hawn, and many others have gained either fame or, like Cheryl Atkinson, who exposed what she believed were failings at CBS, really boldly revealed their own experiences or feelings about the famous people they interacted with, sometimes with a little bit more infamy than fame. I figured a little scandal would be a great way to get back into the world of our history's hotties, so I give you the woman who was able to break into the world of an elusive group, the world of first ladies. Elizabeth Keckley was her name, and while she became, as we might joke today, dressmaker to the stars in her day, Elizabeth's life did not begin well. Born a slave, she was the daughter of slaves Agnes Hobbs and George Pleasant, but it was revealed later that her biological father was actually Colonel Armistead Burwell, Agnes's owner, which of course was not unusual at the time. Agnes was married to George, though he lived on another plantation, but I read differing accounts as to whether he and Agnes were married before or after Elizabeth was conceived. However, it was apparently obvious that Elizabeth had been fathered by a white man. We talked about the abuse of female slaves by mistresses in previous episodes when they received attention from their male owners, though they had no power to resist advances. Once again, Elizabeth is an example of how these white mistresses often resented the female slaves and children they bore by those husbands. Elizabeth was assigned to care for the Burwell children starting at 4 years old and really suffered a lot of abuse at the hands of Mary Burwell, the colonel's wife. What we know about Elizabeth's true parentage explains a lot about how and why this would have happened. Elizabeth would have had a better life as a house slave as far as being dressed and fed goes, but as a living example of Colonel Burwell's indiscretions, her presence really would have raised the ire of her mistress. If you would like to hear more about the treatment of slave women, check out our episode on Linda Brent from a few episodes ago. According to Elizabeth herself, Colonel Burwell seemed to enjoy the misery of his slaves. As Elizabeth grew older, she was given to, though her ownership was not really transferred to, the colonel's son Robert, who was married to a young lady named Margaret. Robert was a minister and a teacher at a school called the Burwell School. His wife, Margaret, behaved really aggressively towards Elizabeth and actually brought in a neighbor to beat her several times. During this time, she was also forced into a relationship with a man named Alexander Kirkland, who fathered her son, George, who she named for her stepfather, her mother Agnes's husband. The relationship lasted for about 4 years, during which she says she really suffered. While we have seen relationships where a slave woman may have agreed to become a white man's mistress to protect her from other men, this does not seem to be that sort of relationship. After this time with Robert and Margaret, Elizabeth was returned to Virginia, where she then began to serve Anne Burwell Garland, who was the daughter of the colonel. So apparently Elizabeth was just passed around among the family. We see some patterns in Elizabeth's life emerge that mesh with some of the traditional images of slaves and also those that do not mesh with the traditional image of what we know about slavery. The Garlands moved out to St. Louis, hoping to create a better life for themselves, but they really had quite a few financial problems when they got there. They sold a few slaves, which was not unusual, but they hired out others, which was a lesser-known practice. Elizabeth was quite the seamstress by this time. She and her mother, while staying with the Garland family, were sewing for income. They were hired out to do piecework, occasionally could bring in extra money for slave-owning families. In addition to this, occasionally slaves would be allowed to earn money for themselves on top of doing piecework for the families. which would have given the slaves interaction with other people on the outside. It would have given them the ability to engage in economic exchange that would have been unusual for slaves who were usually kept completely out of that world. And this turned out to be a real turning point for Elizabeth. She met her husband while living in St. Louis, but did not wish to marry him while she was still a slave. The atmosphere here was such a different experience for both slaves and free black people living and working there that they intermingled, and oftentimes it was just sort of a back and forth where, you know, someone would be a slave that might be in a relationship with a freed person. So while Elizabeth was doing independent work for these outside customers, with the help of several of her patrons, she actually raised $1,200 to buy her freedom for her and that of her son, George. Anne Garland's husband was not a fan of this plan at first, but somehow she convinced him. Elizabeth stayed in St. Louis until she had repaid her patrons, and she did marry the free black man that gave her the name Keckley, but he was really an obscure part of the rest of her life that disappeared quickly. So we'll just move on from that and go on to her moving to the East Coast. She first went to Baltimore thinking that she was going to teach sewing classes to young black women, but realized she didn't have a lot of opportunity there. So she went on to D.C., where she believed she might have more opportunities to earn a living, which turned out to be very true. At the time, there was a fee for a free black person to stay in the city for more than 30 days, which Elizabeth did not have. That is, when her patrons again came to her rescue, one of them wrote a letter to the mayor, James Barrett, who gave her the license for free. As you see, a pattern is emerging. Elizabeth compelled the support and confidence of the women that she worked for, which seems reasonable, considering she most likely sewed not only their dresses, but also their personal garments, giving her a position of confidant to many of these women. This would have been a trait that served her well as she broke her way into the world of Washington, D.C. There were many women who needed clothes for their social life, befitting their social standing. Funny enough, even the wife of Jefferson Davis asked Elizabeth to sew for her and wanted Elizabeth to come and work in the Davis household. So her networking talents were paying off in some really ironic ways. Her refusal shows to go and work in the Davis household shows Elizabeth's shrewd ability to assess her situational well-being. The idea of a guaranteed full-time position with Varnia Davis in the Deep South was not preferable to living on her own reputation and the ability to attract new customers in the D.C. area. Actually, a dress made for the wife of Robert E. Lee led to a lot of word-of-mouth contacts through the entire Washington, D.C., and really to what will build up to be the pinnacle of Elizabeth's time there. Elizabeth's creations became so popular after sewing the dress for Robert E. Lee's wife that Mary McLean of Virginia offered to introduce her to the Lincolns because she wanted Elizabeth to make a dress for her. But Elizabeth said she just did not have the time. So, needless to say, to get that introduction, Elizabeth decided to do the dress for Mrs. McLean. Elizabeth had a flair that was unique at the time, and Mary Lincoln had a taste for beautiful clothes. Her styles were very elegant and very clean, and while many of the young ladies at the time were they were into floral and busy dresses, Elizabeth knew how to bring out the beauty of her clientele with simple designs and fitting the women well rather than trying to catch the eye with too many details. So this is where Elizabeth goes from making a name for herself as a dressmaker extraordinaire to making a name for herself as the woman who told, eventually, Mary Todd's secrets. Elizabeth now had a front seat for the real action. First, she dressed Mary Todd well. Mrs. Lincoln had a youthful look, as we talked about, and also a really good style. And Elizabeth was really known for taking that style and creating it into just really an extraordinary public style for the First Lady. Mrs. Lincoln, by the way, was the first president's wife to be called the First Lady in the press. When Elizabeth began, she did all the sewing herself, but By the time she became the dressmaker for the First Lady, she had a seamstress working with her to do the basic sewing so she could work on details. In addition, Elizabeth could complete more than one project at a time, which was very unusual for a dressmaker of that day. The pictures of Mary Lincoln and two Elizabeth's designs that were taken in 1862 are some of the best evidence showing the real talent of Elizabeth Keckley. So we've moved into the time of the Civil War in the United States, and in addition to all the sewing, Elizabeth was doing relief work by founding the Contraband Relief Association, which later became the Ladies, Freedmen's, and Soldiers Relief Association, offering her help to recently freed slaves as well as wounded soldiers. Elizabeth was able to raise funds from both white and free black patrons alike and distributed funds, food, and clothing widely throughout the next couple of years. The Lincolns experienced a great deal of tragedy during the Civil War and while living in the White House. They had lost their son Willie to typhoid fever and were living through the stress of the Civil War. And during this time, Elizabeth is seeing Mary Todd Lincoln on a regular basis, and she herself had lost her own son the year before in 1861, during the Civil War, and really became a great comfort to Mrs. Lincoln after the death of their son, Willie. According to her memoir, Elizabeth had open communications with the Lincolns, as any personal servant might. She even spoke with the president about the state of slavery. She witnessed personal communication between the president and the First Lady to include discussions where Mary was giving advice on political matters. Now is when the story turns from Keckley and to Mary Lincoln and the relationship between the two women. Mrs. Lincoln sent letters of consolation to Elizabeth when her son died and confided in Elizabeth during her most troubling hours. In the most troubling hour after the president was assassinated, one of the first people that Mary Lincoln sent for was Keckley. Though Keckley did not get the message until the next day, we know that she was one of the first people that Mary Lincoln reached out to. In the following days, Mrs. Lincoln stayed in the White House as the president's body made its way on a 2-week journey to Illinois and then back. And during this time, those 2 weeks, and then when Mary Lincoln went to Chicago in the following weeks, Elizabeth Keckley was with her. There was not really a system in place to care for a widowed First Lady. Mary Lincoln was fighting with Congress over financial support, and as a woman of her station at the time wouldn't have had, she really did not have other ways of supporting herself financially. She would have been reliant on her relatives if there had not been a well-established estate bringing in an income, and Abraham Lincoln had been a little busy running a country when most men of his age would have been expanding their farmlands and passing on a running business to their sons. In fact, at one point, Lincoln's son Robert had his mother declared insane by a court, which took her several months to have overturned, and he did it taking control of her finances, so then, you know, as she had to have it overturned so that she could regain control of her own finances. So Mary Lincoln knew how to be a lady based on her upbringing, and had spent lavishly on renovations in the White House as well as her own wardrobe, which contributed to the debt problems in the Lincoln family. But she had done it because she wanted to support her husband and raise money for the Union, hosting soldiers, volunteering as a nurse, and made it her mission to raise morale. But as the press is, you know, apt to do, all they saw was the spending. They were very unkind to her in the press, and really she developed a bad reputation. So when she went to Congress asking for some sort of relief, she really didn't get a lot of sympathy. Mary Lincoln eventually asked Keckley to accompany her to New York, where she attempted to raise funds to support herself by selling clothes and other items from the presidency. Elizabeth offered to give interviews during this time in New York to restore Lincoln's public image, but when the news of the actual sale of Mary Lincoln's items came out, all hope was lost. There was really nothing that Keckley could do. Mary Lincoln's reputation was just absolutely skewered in the press. Now, how this led Keckley to write an entire memoir, I can only imagine, but she said that she believed it was necessary to tell her story, to shed a positive light on Mary Todd Lincoln. Elizabeth certainly had a ghostwriter, and Frederick Douglass and an editor from New York named James Redpath helped to get the book published. The title was Behind the Scenes, or 30 Years a Slave and 4 Years in the White House. Elizabeth began by telling some of her own story, but did not give great detail of the same type of detail that other slaves who wrote memoirs gave, but then spent a great deal of time talking about the Lincolns and explaining Mrs. Lincoln's motives in the aftermath of the president's death. The real catch, the issue that caused true problems, was that the editor included letters actually written from Mrs. Lincoln to Keckley. So because of that, Mary Lincoln felt betrayed. The book did not have the reaction that Keckley had hoped for and expected. She was the woman who had told the personal secrets of her employer. So even though people weren't necessarily sympathetic to Mary Lincoln, they really didn't like the fact that she had told secrets about her employers. Reactions were somewhere between shock over the revelation of her obvious close relationship with this white family that went probably beyond the bounds of trusted employee, and this fear that people who were angry at her in the public might have their own secrets revealed. The idea that a servant in a genteel woman's bedroom on a daily basis who witnessed every personal movement would share their secrets was so distressing that the bounds of propriety really demanded their disgust at the book. They could not support something that, you know, if turned on them, could do such, they believed, great damage to their own reputations. Of course, the book did not sell well, and then her dress business began to falter. Mary Lincoln was extremely upset by the book, especially the fact that her letters were published, and Elizabeth claimed that Redpath had only asked to borrow the letters from Lincoln, but now they were published, and all the world could see Mrs. Lincoln's innermost thoughts and feelings. Needless to say, as many a famous person has done before, all contact was cut off between Lincoln and her former employee. So what does a black dressmaker in a town of wealthy white women do when they no longer want her to be their personal dressmaker and fitter? Well, at first, Keckley continued to sew for the ladies willing to use her services and to teach sewing classes to young black women. However, eventually she was forced not only to sell some of her relics from the Lincoln White House, but in 1892, at the age of 74, she moved to Ohio to take a job as the head of the Department of Sewing and Domestic Science Arts at Wilberforce University. She even organized a dress exhibit at the Chicago World's Fair, but this was just not enough to pull her back from her former level of earning. She eventually moved back to Washington and into the National Home for Destitute Colored Women and Children and died in 1907. While at the end of her life, she was surrounded by obscurity, and I jokingly compared her to the tell-all generation today. I believe we should remember Keckley differently from her later counterparts. Elizabeth did not tell the secrets of the first family because she needed the income. She was the freedwoman of a former first lady who had been reached out to in the time of financial need. She was the safety net. The bounds of propriety during the time period did not celebrate the hashing of personal details from a servant. And while the newspapers of the day did like to print gossip, there were lines that most people just assumed were going to be respected. So we can only assume that Keckley was telling the truth and that her intention was to aid her friend in the only way she knew how, by reaching out to the same white community that had always supported her in the past, not knowing she had seriously misjudged how her revelations would be interpreted, and the mere existence of her book would far outweigh the compassion for the public figure that she intended it to convey. And that is our episode for today. Again, I am so glad to be back. I am so glad to have you back listening. And I promise you that new episodes will come much quicker in the future. So until next time.